This is the Be A Coach podcast, episode number 13.
Welcome to the Be A Coach podcast, online at thebacoach.com. Helping business analysts do analysis better by helping them take their craft to the next level. It doesn't matter if you are a brand new BA or you've been practicing for many years. There is always something we can all do to take our BA skills and techniques up a notch. And now, here is your host, author, blogger, musician, and BA evangelist, Yaqub Muhammad, also known as Yamo.
Hello everyone, welcome to the BA Coach podcast. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on which part of the world you're in right now. I just wanted to start off this episode with some exciting news about the podcast. Wanted to let you guys know that this podcast was submitted to iTunes a few days ago, and it got approved by Apple, and is available right now for subscription and download from iTunes. So it's really exciting stuff, and it makes it so much more easy now for you guys to subscribe to it and listen to it and have it downloaded while you're sleeping, potentially, right? So I would really, really appreciate it if you can, you know, just go out there, subscribe, and give this podcast a 5-star rating and write a review about how useful it has been to you. I would really appreciate that too. So let's get started with today's episode. We have an interesting podcast lined up today about requirements workshops. What are the ingredients of conducting requirements workshop by Ellen Gottesdiener? This is actually a continuation of episode number 9. So if you haven't listened to that, maybe you can go back a couple episodes and listen to it and get to know about the two books that Ellen wrote and what inspired her to write those two books. So what we are doing today is we will be talking through the ingredients of conducting an effective requirements workshop. And essentially, we pick up the requirements collaboration book and take a section from there that talks about this and talk through that. So you will learn Ellen's insight on these ingredients and how you can apply those when you are conducting your next requirements workshop. So without further ado, here's Ellen on the ingredients of an effective requirements workshop. And one thing that kind of interests me is the first part of the book, mm-hmm. which is the overview of requirements workshops. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about that and get some of your thoughts on, you know, the ingredients of conducting a successful requirements workshop.
Yeah, sure. And this kind of plays with the collaboration patterns as well. Mm-hmm. One of the ingredients is to have a shared purpose. I mean, it sounds quite obvious and easy, but it's not always something that people come into either a room, or if you're doing some of this work in a distributed mode, they don't necessarily have a shared understanding of what the outcome of the work session is, the workshop is. Mm. Interestingly, what I found is that sometimes I would get engaged to do a workshop, and as part of my preparation, I try to, it's very important to be neutral and hear what the community as a whole says, not just whomever is contacting you to do the session. And when I would ask questions about the outcomes of the workshop, I would get totally different points of view. Mm. And sometimes a part of the problem was people weren't clear on the vision for the product or the purpose for the project. Mm. So it was interesting because sometimes I ended up, instead of doing deep drill downs in requirements themselves, I would have to bring the community back to getting a shared understanding of what it was that they were going to build, what was in and out of scope. What might the release strategy be? What were the risks and things like that you do typically during chartering and envisioning and discovery and road mapping?
And does everybody understand like the shared purpose. What happens if some stakeholders, you know, don't have that sense?
Well, then we need to get it. Then part of the workshop is to go after getting that, having a shared understanding. That's first order of business. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the purpose, which is one of the first P in the list of P's that I mentioned before, has to resonate with everybody in the community. So sometimes we may have to spend time in the early part of the session having clear goals and objectives and vision and all those other things. Mm-hmm. So, that's a very, very crucial ingredient to have. And then, of course, that will help drive making sure that we have the right people in the workshop.
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. That kind of, you know, fits into it naturally. Kind of, it initiates the second part.
Exactly. So that's another ingredient, is making sure that we have the right people. Mm. And you know, depending on the project or program, I've had situations where we had to delay the workshop because for logistical reasons, some of those, quote, right people were not available. And my counsel to the team and the planning team that I like to form is, then we need to wait, because we're going to waste time and have an output that needs to be vetted and reviewed by other people that adds lag time and that decreases the quality. And let's make sure we have the right people in the room there together before we do this. And
let me ask you a real question. A real world scenario. What do you do when the right people don't have time, or have limited time? Let me say that.
Well, okay. Well, if they say they don't have time, then that's really helpful to know, because that means that probably this project or program isn't that important. So it's not as important as other things. Let's put it that way. Because you know, we can only get so much air into that balloon before it pops.
Yeah.
Multitasking, too many projects. We know we have lots of data on that. I've just actually recently done some tweets about that. Multitasking doesn't work, and having too many projects in our portfolio doesn't work. We want to only work on a couple of the most critical, most business, highest business value at a time. Mm-hmm. So let's defer. And, you know, the business may change, and maybe that was a wise choice, or maybe the priority will get elevated. Don't do it. Don't do the workshop unless those right people can be there. So that's good information to know. Then don't even get started. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And it's something that they need to prioritize and, you know, put things on top of their list to kind of get the most important project out of the way, right? So
yeah, the community really does sometimes, and sometimes that indicates where people are thrashing on projects and spreading people too thin. Mm-hmm. That's actually a smell, if you will, that the organization is doing too many things and is having trouble being very clear and unambiguous about goals and objectives and trying to do too much at once. And that maybe there's a workshop that would bring the community together. There's a workshop to help them decide what they really want to work on. And that can be a huge saving in time and money and morale if they learn to focus, if they get to focus.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. The third part is shared space, right?
Yeah.
So maybe a little elaboration on that.
Well, you know, we do our best work when we have face-to-face interaction. Mm-hmm. And the workshops that I talk about in the book, and I mentioned a little bit about distributed, but these are really, this is really very much focused on face-to-face, real-time workshop, where they have we have the highest throughput, the highest degree of understanding, and having wall space, and of course the right tools and materials in the room. It's a simple thing, but it's a really, really important thing.
Mm. Nice. So it's like, you know, being at one place altogether, co-location.
Right. And this is something that's obviously in the Agile world, this is a really high value, where we can have the team and the delivery team, including the customer, working in the same shared space. I mean, there's even been research done on how to design that space how to have shared work tables and even how to have for developer delivery teams the size of the monitors and so forth. But the key also is that you can get up and you can walk over to a wall, flip chart paper, have access immediately to draw a diagram, make a list, do a prototype, have what Mary Gorman and I are calling like a mood board, where you're looking at all, say, the elements, the requirements, models or mock-ups and prototypes all in front of you. So that's what we're building in these workshops. So we can just look up and look at the wall, and people start to get a visual memory. Well, when we worked on this, and they look up and they point to the wall, and that's very, very powerful. So it facilitates us having a shared mental model of what it is we're building as well.
Nice, and that kind of, you know, brings the team together as well, because it binds them together.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Nice. So what are WISE groups? Are they like focus groups or...
Well, I use the ingredient of WISE groups to mean basically, like Aristotle said, the whole is more than the sum of the parts.
Uh-huh.
The part is more than a fraction of the whole. Uh-huh. So when you get really smart people together and they have shared purpose and they have built trust, mm-hmm. and they have diversity of experience and knowledge and perspective, you're creating something bigger than any one person or any one small group. And with appropriate, you know, true facilitation, you're letting the group, it's a very generative process, you're letting the group be bigger than any one thing, and they have, any one person rather, and they really do have a lot of collective wisdom and energy. Mm-hmm. So I've observed and always strive myself to do this, that the best facilitators, in a very easy, non-pushy way, bring out that diversity and that wisdom and draw on that from the group in almost an effortless way, and let the group take ownership and responsibility for what needs to happen and for the decisions that will be made and how they will move forward. And I guess it's kind of like, well, you're going to be a father soon.
Oh yeah.
And so, you know, when you're a parent of young kids, I have two sons who are both in university now, in college.
Oh, nice.
But when they're little, you know, you're pretty directive. You know, you can also command them or pick them up and move them around.
Uh-huh.
But in parenting, your greatest joy and pride, some of them, is where you can step back and you watch your child blossom and bloom and do their own thing, and you know your work is done, there's no more for you to do, and they have what you've been able to equip them with. That's kind of like what being a facilitator is. If you've been able to help the group move through those very crucial, you can't cheat dynamics, mm-hmm. of forming, storming, norming, performing, and adjourning. Mm-hmm. If they're moving into norming and performing, the key thing, especially in performing, is just to step back. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have to do as parents. You know, it's kind of a funny analogy, but it for me resonates.
Yeah, no, I can totally visualize that. You know, it's an important process, and to recognize how it all connects and blends together.
Yeah, WISE groups.
WISE groups. So of course, pre-work is another important element, and
yeah.
it's all about being prepared for the workshop. So what are the key elements in your mind to being prepared?
Well, the preparation is not just the facilitator, Jakob, it's also the participants.
Hmm.
So depending on the complexity of the work products that are going to be developed in the workshop, or I should say workshops, because often a good design might be a series of workshops with work in between over a period of time. And so you have to sort of lay out that that strategy for multiple workshops as well. To get the outputs that you want, you have to have some inputs and you have to have some completion criteria. So what I like to do and recommend doing is forming a planning team. And the planning team is comprised of the facilitator and a balance of somebody from the voice of the technology, the technical side, the technical stakeholder, and somebody from the voice of the business, and if possible, from the voice of the customer. So essentially, you want at least to have two other people, somebody on the tech side, somebody, say, maybe the business sponsor or a delegate that has time to work on the planning and design. And so we come together and figure out what do we need to have as outputs, what are the criteria for completion or doneness tests for those, and then we back into what inputs might be. I mean, if I'm going into a workshop where we're going to be doing some detailed requirements work, then we need to have a shared understanding of what the scope is, what's in and out of scope, and what may be the major features, or if you're using use cases or scenarios, depending on your method. So that all might be pre-work or have come from a prior workshop. So the planning team may be building those and vetting those ahead of time. Even something at pre-work that I think is extremely valuable is that checklist of completion criteria, so that everyone coming into the workshop, we go over this at the beginning, understands how do we know we've created a good set of products. You know, that if you're doing some detailed scenarios, for example, or use cases for those using use cases, that we have a good set of use cases. What are the, you know, how do we test our outputs? And so, you know, when I wrote this book, I used that idea of doneness. And that actually is the same term the Agile community uses for doneness, for an iteration and for a release and so forth. That is really important part of the pre-work. So
it's kind of a, like, you know, mini milestones or acceptance criteria for that portion of work.
Exactly, exactly. And we want to start with some of those draft models potentially. So maybe if we are doing scoping, folks in the planning team might come up with a draft, say, context diagram and list of business scenarios, right, and events. And we know that they may be incomplete or wrong or have missing things, and that's okay, but we want to start with something. We never come into a workshop, to use the Latin expression, tabula rasa, with blank slate. We have something to start with, you know, there's some material to work with. That's really important for the facilitator to get the group going and to get some traction early on with something that's not too difficult and complex, because you don't want to do the, don't want to jump out of the gate with having folks collaborating around something that's really, really complex.
Exactly. Yeah, you need certain purpose and some, you know, guideposts to help you out along the way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And then you say focus questions. Is that something more like an underlying theme that you use to elicit information from your stakeholders?
Yeah, focus question is just that. It's a very clear question that we want the participants to answer in order to get them to create a model or a list, or they could even be an overarching focus question for a whole activity or the whole workshop. When I talk about focus questions in the book, what I'm specifically doing is saying we should design and have a list and be prepared to ask these focus questions to generate the products of the workshop, the deliverables, and to evaluate those deliverables. I put a bunch as part of writing the book, because you can't put everything in the book, and I wanted to have practitioner resources available on the book website. which you'll provide that, Jakob. On the book website, you can download an example list of focus questions that you would ask to elicit work by the team for certain models, such as, you know, a use case or scenarios or events or a context diagram, data model, etc. So as a facilitator, you want to have at the ready or be able to ask very clear, concise, focused questions and then give directions for where people will write things down, what tools and media they'll use. This really, really important accelerator, very, very simple thing, but a very important accelerator to group work.
Absolutely, and I can certainly provide that link as well.
Great.
And serious play, that's like almost like an oxymoron.
It is an oxymoron. I love oxymorons, and that's one of them. I love oxymorons. In fact, I have a talk that I've been giving for a couple of years called Agile Requirements, Not an Oxymoron.
Okay.
But this is a wonderful oxymoron. It's actually also the title of a book by Michael Schrage, who's with MIT Media Labs, who researched innovation in high-tech companies. And he found that, indeed, as you would imagine, that for innovation and creativity, playing with the product, with the design, doing prototypes is very powerful. So we want to interject throughout our workshops serious play. And serious play, part of serious play includes the modeling, because we're playing around with models and walking around those models of our requirements in order to play around with our understanding and our ideas, you know, because you know, those requirements don't just jump out of nowhere. We are often not sure what we want until we start to explore or play with it a bit.
Yeah.
So the modeling activities are a form of serious play. We want to do opening and energizer activities that give people a little bit of play. I mean, this is not playtime fun for the sake of fun, but for energizing, for building trust, which is the next topic, which is so crucial.
Yeah.
Debriefing our activities, having a bit of levity with meaning is very powerful.
Absolutely. And maybe at this point, you said trust. So what are some of your tips, like through your experience and, you know, based on the research you've done, what are some of the tips that the BA community could use to, you know, build solid trust with stakeholders, especially when you go into requirements workshop? That is, I think that's a pretty crucial element, what you say and, you know, how people believe you, well, what you say.
Yeah. Well, and that's not something that, you know, is an automatic thing. That comes with
time.
With time. It does come with time, but I think that the facilitators is very responsible for finding out, and this is part of why the pre-work is so helpful to do, is there trust issues in that community? What is the degree of safety that people have with each other? Because if there is not that safety, we won't really, to be practical, you're not going to get the quality that we really need to have. So it actually saves time to have trust. So we may have to make some time where there's a lot of distrust to work through those issues, but, you know, not singing Kumbaya, but along the deeper underlying, as we call them, hidden agendas that may be at hand. And we may need to surface those very early in the workshop. And that's why the pre-work is really important. So there's little things that we want to do. One of the important ones is around decision making. And I talk about this in more detail in the book about how important it is to have very clear clarity around decisions. Decisions can be and need to be an outcome of the workshop.
Yeah.
We're going to decide this is our release strategy. We're going to decide this is in scope, this is out of scope. This is that we're going to decide these are the rules we're going to use for this use case requirements feature, and so forth and so on. So as the facilitator, part of planning, working with the planning team, I want to help them become very explicit about what decisions will be made in the workshop and, importantly, what are our decision rules? How will we decide how to decide?
Yeah.
it's a subtle thing, and I've actually got an article called Decide How to Decide that I wrote before I actually wrote the book, but subtle but powerful thing to be very explicit with that. Work with the group to have them all understand what are the decisions we're going to be making and what is the decision rules that we'll use and what's the process that we'll use. And I like to practice it right away in the beginning of the workshop. So they build trust in the process, which helps them build trust, folks build trust with each other.
Yeah, and that's kind of, you know, a foundation for, you know, even making effective decisions, quick decisions.
Oh my God, you're so right. And then the group can really move quickly, because I like to think of trust. I've read some years ago, and Mary Gorman turned me on to the Reynos, who have written about trust. And the workshops are a really great forum for building the three types of trust they talk about, which are so important on any in any community, any project, program, community that the workshops can be a genesis for, and that is contractual trust, communication trust, and competence trust. Right. So contractual trust, that we have agreement that you'll look out for my interest, I'll look out for yours, and of course having purpose there is really helpful. Communication trust, that we'll be honest and frequently communicating and transparent, and if we mess up, we'll say that, and we'll look for, this is a real important element of workshops, we constantly pause and look for feedback. How are we doing? So, you know, I as the facilitator need to pause and say, okay, let's just check in, see how we're doing here, and open the door, open the floor for saying, this is, you know, what we just did. We look at this. How are we doing as a community? How's our product going? How are we interacting? And when the group's moved in their cycle of dynamics into norming, we can start letting them adjust the process. And we start to relinquish control to process, and we just really now are doing what we call, you know, true facilitation. The word means to make easy.
Yeah.
So we're not telling them what to do. As they build communication trust, they can discuss and provide feedback to each other and make suggestions for adjusting the process. So they have higher velocity and higher quality.
And moreover, of the free flow, right? So if they have some thoughts or concerns, they need to come out more easily. And it will happen through communication trust, for sure.
Yes. And so the facilitator's job is to open the space for that to happen. Sometimes it's really challenging as a facilitator. For example, I found when groups were in conflict or arguing or not, you know, arms folded, the nonverbal behaviors are very strong about lack of trust, to ask a focus question or make an observation and just be quiet.
Yeah. And sometimes listening is the most important talking you can do.
Right. Very well. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then that, just to go back to the last type of trust, it's competence trust. And workshops are a great format for building competence trust and building mutual respect and learning in our skills and understanding of what that the requirements are, what the product we're trying to build, and so forth.
Yeah.
So trust.
Absolutely. Trust is so important.
It is. It's very key.
Nice. And I see a bunch of other elements too. And one thing that caught my eye, actually two things, process variety and using both sides of the brain.
And those are actually very related, Jakob. So that was a very interesting selection on your part. Because they really intertwine with each other. Process variety means that, you know, in many meetings, classic meetings, people are just sitting there. And usually one person is talking and they're taking turns or somebody is dominating. Process variety means that we're doing different things at different points in time. I might be at one point sitting, writing a list of something or drawing a picture on a poster or just working alone, Another point, I might be in a small group having discussion, writing things on cards, standing at a wall, posting things, grouping things, grouping items. So that's small group activity. Or we may be working together as a whole group doing, say, what I call the Wall of Wonder, working on a storyboard activity. Mm-hmm. So small group, whole group, individual time. You know, we have to remember some of the process of variety does include somebody just having maybe a minute or a half a minute to think quietly alone. And that's important for two reasons. One is that to think well together, we have to think well alone first. Mm-hmm. So we want to draw on that. And the second is that we want to be mindful that there are different preferences that people have for communicating in the room. Yeah. And, you know, many of us are familiar with the Myers-Briggs type indicator, which has one of the modes is how we take in information and how we communicate with folks. Some people, basically, it goes to the introvert-extrovert dimension. Some people need time to think, and they don't need to talk and say things out loud.
Yeah.
Other people, the extroverts, will just start blurting things out even though they haven't thought them
very well. or they will think out loud.
Yes, exactly. And that's how they do need to think. Uh-huh. They need to speak to think. But what about the introverts? We need some time for the introverts to be able to process what's going on and what they're thinking and draw from their wisdom. I mean, I can't tell you how many times in a workshop where injecting some quiet time and then asking for in rounds of some sort, asking for input, or if there's a lot of dominators, limiting people's time to talk, and then perhaps inviting some of the folks that tend to be introverted in meeting to speak, or just making eye contact and pausing when I'm holding the floor as the facilitator and looking at them to invite them in a nonverbal way to talk. That's really, really important. So, you know, the process variety is crucial to the facilitator. And the both sides of the brain, of course, Jakob, that probably you're familiar with the two sides.
Yes, I know. As a matter of fact, you know, I'm working on these mind maps right now. And mind maps are a classical example of using both sides of your brain, logical side and the artistic side.
Yeah, exactly. Right. The right brain is the visual spatial brain. The left brain is the logical analytic, you know, the mathematic brain. Yeah. That left side, unfortunately, is the only one that we test for in the school systems in the U.S.
Yes. Everywhere, pretty much.
Yeah. But some of us have a preference one way or the other, right? So, you know, I don't know. Are you a list maker? Are you a picture drawer? What are you?
I try to be both as much as possible.
That's great.
Because I'm also a musician. I play the guitar and stuff. So I do tend to, you know, enjoy that realm of things.
Yeah, so you might be more right brain, but you, like most of us, can draw on the left side of your brain. So in the workshop, we want to use work products around the room that draw on both sides of the brain, both visual and so we'll have requirements represented both visual ways using models and diagrams and textual ways using tables and lists, for example. And they both have strengths and weaknesses, and we want to use both in the workshop.
Nice. And what's collaborative closure? It's more like having a solid finish to your workshops all along, or is it just one big bang finish?
Well, it's all along the way, as you say. So we're very clear on decisions. Mm-hmm. If we've made a decision, okay, this is in scope, this is out of scope, checking in for agreement. And this is where I mentioned earlier the idea of having clear decisions, decision rules, and a decision process, so we're not churning around decision making. Yes, we're done with that decision. We've made clear. We have clear acceptance criteria. We've checked in for participatory decision making. Yeah. So we want to do that as we go throughout the workshop. And some decisions, you know, they build, one decision builds on another. So of course, as a designer of a workshop, we need to make sure that the agenda flows with decisions that are going to be built incrementally throughout the session or sessions. So we want to pause and be very clear every time we're trying to reach closure on something that we have reached closure. Mm-hmm. Some facilitators will, and I like to do this at times too, we'll have a poster just labeled decisions. Yeah. And as a decision is made, we have somebody write that on a card or a post, and we slap that up there, and it's right there on the wall.
And these go in as part of maybe a decision log that's maintained by the team.
That's one way to do it, yep. And certainly we have the proceedings, if you will, from the workshop, and we want to publish them, not just to the attendees, but to a broader community. Sometimes what we do to also be very clear and explicit about these is have, at the end of the workshop or series of workshops, have a show and tell, where we pull in the key upper sponsors to the workshop, to the product and the program, and they get to get a show and tell. It's a really very cool process because the participants are the stars of the show. They basically go through, here's what our plan, you know, here's what our planned outcomes were, and here's what they are. Here's the decisions we made. Here's the issues that we need your help from. Here's the process we went through, and it's very, very powerful education for the sponsors. Mm-hmm. And it also allows the sponsors to see what they need to do to enable the success of the project and or program. And it's, that process is also part of closure for the group. It's part of their adjourning process to sort of summarize what happened and they learned and what they're going to go forward with on the project.
Absolutely, and I think these are all very important, crucial elements for a successful workshop. And, you know, Ellen, based on your experience, maybe you thought about a few things after you wrote the book and all along. If you have some tips, let's say, you know, just something that our BAs could use, let's say tomorrow, for doing and conducting a successful requirements workshop. Just to kind of summarize the whole discussion we've had, what would you recommend them?
Well, I guess the first thing that comes to mind maybe are three tips. Plan.
Wow, those are really unique.
or maybe prepare.
Nice. Similar one. Okay.
That's the first thing. That's a very, when we do our training, our facilitation, JAD facilitation training, that's a huge learning point. Mm-hmm. Another I think is around, I would recommend being really, create a set of skills, facilitation skills, specific ones that you want to go after, and build them every day. I'll give you a very specific example. I think one of the most important, number one skill of a good facilitator, of a great facilitator, is observation. So that's something we can build every day. You, next time you go into any group meeting, session of any sort, ratchet up your observation skills. In fact, when we do our training, we have a simulation. Some people are role players, and there's a facilitator in roles, and they have scripts, or they have a guideline, and then we have observers. And I give out a list of an observation checklist, and tell them, you be prepared as you watch the simulation, take notes, look at these observation questions, and be ready, because the most important part of our simulation is actually the retrospective of the simulation, and be ready to share your observations. So if we can build our skills as observers, th- so that you're looking and watching at a meta, you know, the meta process of mm-hmm. what's going on. That's going to help us as facilitators know, you know, when's a good time to intervene, when's a good time to ask a question, what's happening in the group, how's the energy. There's so many, there's little things that will make a huge difference. So my first recommendation is to build your skills as a really good observer.
Nice. And I think it's a pretty valuable skill to have, because you will start watching a lot of clues that people emanate, and you know, I think it's a very crucial thing to have.
Yeah, it can really help. And I wrote an article not too long ago called Guerrilla Facilitation.
Interesting.
And we can get you the link to that.
Sure.
And in that, it also requires you to be observing before you do your guerrilla facilitation. So it's sort of a first principle.
Nice. Interesting. Maybe I'll just put out a link for that.
Great. That would be great.
Cool. So any other tips for conducting successful workshops?
Wow. Well, I mean, I hope the book will be helpful. There's
Absolutely.
Lots of suggestions in there, specific ways to plan and prepare, and focus questions, even things like on the website, checklists of materials and supplies.
Yeah.
But those are the hot ones that I would like to suggest today.
Nice, awesome. I'll link up all those good items in the blog post so that anybody listening to this can also have access to that.
That's great. I appreciate you doing that.
Thanks for listening, guys. I hope that was useful and inspiring for you. If you want more business analysis tips, listen to other shows, and also get a free ebook on 5 pillars of a great business analyst, please visit thebacoach.com and sign up for our free e-newsletter. And if you could, I would love for you to go ahead and comment on the blog post for this episode, and also tell me what you want to hear out of this podcast. Just tell me anything that has intrigued you or bothered you, and I will work towards creating an episode to include that topic. Thanks, guys. Hope to see you on thebacoach.com. Bye for now.